This is the BBC, with the Daily Minutes podcast. Oh no, it isn't. I mean, this is the Daily Minutes podcast. This is, however, not the BBC.
Abend an alle Funkamateure und Doppel-ULs hier am Kanal.
Daily Minutes Podcast number 1645 with today's bulletin, 10 June 2019. This is a bulletin for Monday. Daily Minutes is a podcast in either English or Dutch, or a mix of both, on several topics with a strong focus on technical topics like amateur radio and shortwave listening. This podcast today will be both in Dutch and English. This Monday is still a holiday here in the Netherlands. Vandaag een uitzending in het Nederlands en het Engels. We beginnen met deel 21 van de serie over zelfbouw. Vervolgens gaan we verder met in het Engels met de column Foundations of Amateur Radio van Onno. Daarna is er een aflevering van The Doctor is In van de ERRL. En aan het eind van de uitzending is er weer een aflevering van Slow Scan Radio zoals die eerder dit jaar werd uitgezonden. Today we will start with between 5 and 6 minutes in Dutch. It's episode 21 from a series about homebrewing. Of electronics, that is to say. After that, we will continue in English with VK6FLAB's Foundations of Amateur Radio. After that, there's an episode of ARRL's The Doctor is In about stringing up antennas. How do you get your antenna all up in a tree? Dit is deel 21 van de serie over zelfbouw. In deel 20 hebben we het vooral gehad over hoogte en over brandveiligheid. Dit keer begin ik met sluipende gevaren. Bijvoorbeeld het lood dat er in ouderwets soldeert in zit, we hebben het daar al eerder over gehad, dat is niet goed voor je gezondheid. Lood heeft, zoals de meeste zware metalen, de neiging om zich in het lichaam op te slaan. Tot aan een bepaalde waarde heb je daar weinig last van, maar boven een bepaalde grens kun je daar ineens zeer vervelende gezondheidsproblemen door krijgen. Lood is daarbij nog extra gevaarlijk voor kinderen. Gevaren zitten niet altijd daar waar je ze verwacht. Solderen kan bijvoorbeeld ook acute loodvergiftiging veroorzaken. Zo ken ik het voorbeeld van iemand die op een bepaald moment alleen een Amerikaanse soldeerbout voor 110 volt bij de hand had. Zo'n ouderwetse zonder thermostaat. Hij wilde op zijn aandacht even snel een draadje ergens aan solderen. Nadat hij klaar was haalde hij de stekker weer uit het stopcontact om te voorkomen dat de bout te warm zou worden vanwege die 110 volt. Meteen daarna voelde hij zich ineens niet lekker, iets wat in rap tempo erger werd. Hij zag vervolgens dat hij niet de stekker van de soldeerbout eruit getrokken had, maar die van het koffiezetapparaat die er sprekend op leek. De soldeerbout zelf die was gloeiend heet. Zijn gezondheid ging vervolgens zo snel achteruit dat zijn vrouw hem met spoed naar de eerste hulp van het ziekenhuis bracht. Daar werd hij direct op de intensive care opgenomen en na de omstandigheden van wat er gebeurd was te hebben verteld, was de conclusie al snel dat hij acute loodvergiftiging had opgelopen. Door de te hoge temperatuur van de soldeerbout was een klein deel van het lood in de soldeertin in de vorm van damp vrijgekomen en door het in te ademen had hij een levensgevaarlijke hoeveelheid daarvan in zijn lichaam gekregen. Hij moest vervolgens nog een week in het ziekenhuis blijven, waarbij hij diverse behandelingen onderging om te voorkomen dat het binnengekregen lood ook in zijn lichaam zou blijven. Hij moest daarna ook nog diverse malen in het ziekenhuis terugkomen. Ik bedoel maar. Er zijn meer gevaarlijke stoffen in de check. Sommige onderdelen, vaak transistoren en buizen en oude TL-verlichting, bevatten het gevaarlijke berylliumoxide. Dat is een zeer harde stof, maar als het breekt of als je eraan feilt, kunnen er levensgevaarlijke deeltjes vrijkomen die bij inademing langdurige ziekte en overlijden kunnen veroorzaken. Ook in spuitbussen, verf of in lijm zit in beperkte mate gevaarlijke stoffen. Als je de gebruiksaanwijzing volgt en de materialen niet gebruikt voor toepassingen waarvoor ze niet gebruikt zijn, dan kun je daarmee buiten de gevarenzone blijven. Maar ik zal altijd op mijn hoede zijn. Er zijn nog meer sluipende gevaren. Een verkeerde zithouding kan bijvoorbeeld rugklachten veroorzaken. Daar heb je niet alleen thuis, maar ook op je werk last van. Dit is zeker geen grap dus. En als je heel veel zit te solderen of achter de computer zit, denk dan eens na of bijvoorbeeld de stoel die je daarbij dus gebruikt wel geschikt is. Als je veelvuldig snel achter elkaar dezelfde beweging uitvoert, bijvoorbeeld bij het seinen van morsen of bij het solderen van elektronica, dan ligt ook RSI op de loer, een muisarm. Dit kun je vrij eenvoudig voorkomen. Een belangrijke factor hierbij is de temperatuur van de ruimte waarin je werkt. Hoe kouder, hoe eerder je RSI oploopt. Wat ook goed werkt is om de 10 of 20 minuten even opstaan en 30 seconden of een minuut pauze houden. Vooral het al te fanatiek en gespannen werken lijkt een bepalende factor bij het ontstaan van RSI te zijn. Een zorg die door verschillende mensen van zowel binnen als buiten onze hobby vaak verschillend wordt ervaren, zijn de al dan niet gevaarlijke eigenschappen van het middelpunt van onze hobby, de hoogfrequentgolven zelf. Er zijn mensen die aangeven dat ze overgevoelig zijn voor radiogolven. Bij dat soort dingen kan logisch nadenken vaak wel een stuk helpen, hoewel bij straling misschien niet duidelijk kan zijn dat de oorzaak van iemands ellende bij die radiostraling ligt. Mensen staan al zeker 100 jaar lang bloot aan hoogfrequentgolven van de meest uiteenlopende sterktes. Voor de een is die belasting groter dan voor de andere, bijvoorbeeld vanwege beroep of wanneer je zendamateur bent. Echter, straling komt wel meer en meer voor, sowieso, zodat als er een minimaal gevaar is, het puur door die aantallen wel een keer aan de oppervlakte zou moeten komen. Niettemin hebben wetenschappers nog steeds niet kunnen aantonen dat er een verband bestaat tussen straling en gezondheidsgevaren. Ook niet door bijvoorbeeld statistisch onderzoek te doen. Er zijn bijvoorbeeld betrouwbare statistische gegevens bekend over de gezondheid van mensen in de eerste helft van de jaren 90, toen er nog nauwelijks mobiele telefoons waren. Aan de hand van die gegevens en vergelijking met dezelfde gegevens, maar dan verzameld nadat het gebruik van mobieltjes zo normaal is geworden als dit tegenwoordig nog is, kun je hoe dan ook niet vaststellen dat bepaalde ziektebeelden nu, met die honderden miljoenen mobiele telefoons en al die opstelpunten, vaker voorkomen dan daarvoor. Bij fysiotherapeuten, dat voorbeeld gebruik ik wel vaker, wordt wereldwijd al sinds kort na de Tweede Wereldoorlog een therapievorm gegeven met diathermie. Dat is een behandelwijze die met name ook bij sporters populair is, met name ook bij topsporters. Hierbij wordt met hoogfrequent energie het spierweefsel, vaak in de bovenbenen, van binnenuit opgewarmd. Gewoonlijk wordt daarbij 27 MHz gebruikt, of tegenwoordig een ISM-frequentie rond 800 MHz of 2400 MHz. Het meest gebruikte hoogfrequent vermogen daarbij is tussen de 600 en de 1200 watt. Dit vermogen wordt met zogenaamde pads onverzwakt op het spierweefsel losgelaten. Deze opmerkelijke behandelwijze, die bij veel fysiotherapeuten wereldwijd wordt gegeven, wordt overal als volstrekt veilig beschouwd. Het gaat hier dus om hele andere zendvermogens dan bijvoorbeeld bij mobiele telefoons of bij wifi-routers. Het moet dus, als het er is, een uiterst zeldzaam fenomeen zijn en de gevaren zijn waarschijnlijk beperkt. Iets wat je niet kent is echter eerder beangstigend dan iets waarmee je vertrouwd bent. Het aantal slachtoffers van dit soort straling moet zonder enige twijfel vrij klein zijn. Verkleiner in elk geval dan de 650 verkeersdoden en enkele tienduizenden gewonden die er jaarlijks vallen bij ongelukken in het verkeer.
Foundations of Amateur Radio. Today I'm going to go sideways to move forward. In amateur radio we consider circuits, components such as transistors, inductors, capacitors, crystals, and how they're connected to each other. The framework in which that exists is embodied by the field of electronics, and how these components can be mixed together to shape a radio that you can build or buy. In a software-defined radio, there are electronics and components, to be sure, but the bulk of the work is done in the field of software, and today I'm going to look at that. Computers surround us, in our workplace, in our home, on the street, in our hospitals, across our society. Each of these devices is running a thing called software. As opposed to hardware, a physical thing, software is intangible, in much the same way as your date of birth is intangible. You cannot hold your birth date in the air and point at it. You could write it down onto a piece of paper and point at the piece of paper that has the date on it, but you'd be pointing at a piece of paper, not your actual birth date. Computers work in much the same way. You cannot point at software, nor can you hold it in your hand. You can print it out onto paper and point at that, but you'd end up with a deforestation problem that far exceeds the stripping of all the trees in the Amazon rainforest. To make matters more complex, there are at least two types of software, human-readable and computer-readable. You can translate human-readable source code into a computer-readable executable with a tool called a compiler. But doing it in the other direction is much harder. Think of the ink on the paper that describes your date of birth. You can put the ink on the paper, but putting it back into the pen is more complex. All this is leading somewhere, I promise. A little while ago, I started digging into how software-defined radios work. And if you've been following along on my journey, there'll be parts that you can follow, parts that you sort of get, and bits that seem like black magic. This will be different for each person. My black magic is not going to be the same as yours, and the things I understand without thinking might make your head explode. If that's not enough, the goalposts keep moving. As I said, I started digging. Much like peeling an onion, removing layer by layer, I've been exploring and learning and hopefully sharing my excitement along the way. The other day, a mate of mine came by with a new toy, a QRP or low-power HF radio. The device itself is entirely driven by software. That is, it's a software-defined radio. It has some knobs and buttons, a display, a power socket, a plug for a microphone, an antenna, a speaker port, and some other bits and pieces, but underneath all that is software. What's special about this radio is that the software is open source. That is, you can peek inside and see what the code looks like before it becomes ink on the page, the human-readable source code rather than the computer-readable executable. I've touched on open source before, and perhaps I should spend some time on that soon, but for now, think of it as a set of rules that dictate how you are allowed to use source code. As any self-respecting IT geek, I went to the website where the software is available and downloaded it. What struck me was that it was much simpler than I had expected. Don't get me wrong, this is a complex piece of software, not something I'm expecting to pick up in an hour or even a week. But it's simple, as in digestible. I can point at different bits and understand what they do. This part does Morse code, that does FM, over here is RTTY, and look, over here is FreeDV. If you're wondering, I'm describing the UHSDR, or Universal Ham Software Defined Radio Project. Built originally by Chris, Mike Zero, November Kilo Alpha, and Clint, Kilo Alpha 7, Oscar Echo India, and sporting an impressive list of contributors, this software offers insight into receiving and transmitting using an SDR across a variety of amateur radio modes, including SSB, AM, FM, synchronous AM, FreeDV, RTTY, CW, as well as CAT or computer-aided transceiver, sometimes referred to as rig control or remote control, a way of using an external computer to control a radio. The beauty of this software lies in its simplicity. Unlike many other projects, there is no code dealing with Windows or with macOS. There is no mouse, touchscreen, or any other complex user interface. There is a limited set of buttons, a few dials, and a screen for output. The end result is that the level of complexity is much lower than you'd find if you were to start digging into something like PowerSDR or some other code base. The point is that the UHSDR project is a really accessible way to start digging into the software behind a software-defined radio, and another path into this magical hobby of amateur radio. I'm Ono, Victor Kilo 6, Foxtrot Lima Alpha Bravo.
This is The Doctor Is In, your bi-weekly podcast that discusses all things technical and not so technical. The Doctor Is In podcast is produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, and sponsored by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST editor Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the doctor himself, Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
What did the bard say, Joel? Something about suffering the slings and arrows of...
Oh, my God. I think we're going to do that today.
Yeah. We're going to suffer the slings and arrows. And by that, I mean, we're going to talk about getting antennas up in the air. Now, not necessarily big floppy yaggies on towers. I mean, we know that not everybody owns those. However, many people are like me. They've got wire dipole antennas, various wire antennas. And the big problem, and has been for me for many years, is getting the darn wires up and over the trees.
Indeed. Well, before we start, I think it's worth mentioning that when you're hearing this for the first time, it should be June 6th, which is D-Day plus 75 years. And I think that's worth mention.
Absolutely.
And I was thinking today, I guess I was in the Army on D-Day plus 17, I guess. But about that time, The Longest Day came out as a movie, Cornelius Ryan's book.
Excellent.
And if you haven't seen that, I recommend it to give you an idea of what these people went through, and there's still some of them around, and it's worth a thank you and a remembrance.
Absolutely. So,
but anyway, yeah, I think wire antennas are probably the most popular numerically amateur radio antennas, just based on my own sense of what people have. And, frankly, while Yagis and Towers are more expensive and somewhat more visible. They're actually easier once you decide to do them and get somebody on board to install all the stuff. You just stand back and write checks.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas wire antennas is a whole different thing. And I remember growing up, I was a ham since I was 13, and I used to be able to climb trees, but there's only so far you can get in a tree before you start worrying about coming down faster than the antenna does. But I'd look up at these upper branches and say, boy, I wish there were a way that I could get this wire up 60 feet, because then I would really get out as opposed to having it up at 30 feet, which was the same level as the ground behind my house, actually. But nowadays, that's not an issue in the same way. There are lots of ways to do it. After I couldn't climb trees anymore, I used to get neighborhood kids to do it for me. That was before the days of worrying about liability and stuff. Interestingly, I was just thinking about it. That was like 50 years ago I was doing that, and two of the kids that helped me 50 years ago are still hams today. So I guess it got them interested enough, and we spent a lot of time in my basement together.
Here, come throw this rock, or shoot this arrow over the tree. But I don't know how many people are shooting arrows over trees, though. Put up antennas.
That can be effective. I mean, there are a lot of ways. I mean, basically any kind of missile that you can get over a tree, a line gun used between ships would be handy, for example. Although it's a little overkill.
Yes.
And you do have to worry about downrange stuff.
Oh, yeah.
When you go over a tree, you come down on the other side of the tree. Now, oftentimes the tree makes it hard to see what's over there. And if it happens to be your neighbor mowing the lawn, you can get in big trouble and spend a lot of time in court dealing with that afterwards if you don't check it out ahead of time and make sure that the neighbor's okay with you doing it. In my yard, many of my trees are along the edge of the property. So if I go over a tree from my house's side, it comes down in the yard of a neighbor. Probably true of many people. So keep that in mind as well. I think there are many ways that share the same basic idea, which is you get some kind of a projectile over a tree limb with nylon fishing line, light fishing line attached to it, and you pull it back with a piece of twine attached to it to then pull up a progressively larger size rope and so forth until you get a halyard up there that can pull an antenna.
That's why I do it, generally.
Yeah. So you don't want to try to put the antenna on the fishing line because you'll end up doing it multiple times because the fishing line will break. But you want to do it in stages. And I have a few rules about these things for any of these methods. Rule one is prepare all your lead sinkers by painting them with visibility orange or some color that will show up in your foliage. I guess in the fall, visibility orange may not be the best choice, but pick a color that'll work.
And these are the sinkers that you're going to shoot over the limbs of the tree, maybe with a slingshot.
Exactly. I guess if you're using an arrow, the arrow will act in the same way.
That's true.
And if you're using a potato launcher, the potato will act in the same way. But whatever it is, it's important to be able to see it, because when it goes over a limb and comes down on the other side, the first four times for me never go in exactly the right place. So I have to do it again. Now, if you make the critical mistake of reeling it in after you've made a mistake, what will invariably happen is that the line, the fishing line will make a pair of half hitches around some limb up 75 feet.
Yes.
And then you'll never get it back. And you'll have to cut the line off down at the reel. And after a while, you'll have a kind of Christmas tree in the of lead sinkers hanging from your tree with fishing line on the other side, and you'll run out of both lead sinkers and fishing line. So the way to do it is to, if you make a mistake, and we will, find the lead sinker, disconnect the fishing line, and then you can reel the fishing line in without any problem. And you put the sinker in your pocket and you hook it up again, and you go through it again. But if you try to pull it back, so this looks easy, it will swing around and you'll never get it out.
The weight, whatever it is, whether it's a sinker or whatever, will swing as you're trying to draw it back up.
Absolutely.
And of course, it'll just wrap itself right around a tree limb, and then you're stuck.
So literally.
You're far better off just disconnecting the weight and then drawing the line back over the branch.
And you can do that in a number of ways. I mean, you can just tie the line. But actually, when you go to the fishing store to buy the sinkers, they also have little clips that are sort of like safety pins, but half the size, and they're designed to fit through there. So you can actually just unclip it and clip it on at the other end for the next pass. So that's a good way to do it. Now, how do you get this sinker over the tree? There are a number of ways. There's a slingshot product that we've used called Easy Hang.
We've reviewed that in QSD.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it works reasonably well. I've gotten lines up 75, 100 feet with that. I have some pretty tall trees. The aim is a little tricky with that. But I guess if you're good with a slingshot, if anybody's a master at that, that makes it easier. But it works reasonably well. The other thing that works extremely well, in my experience, is a fishing casting rod.
I've never had any luck with that. I'm not contradicting you, but I just don't have the ability. I'm not a fly caster, you know.
Yeah, I'm not either. And I guess I was impressed with a friend came over and put up halyards for me. And he just, he was a good fisherman. And he just sent it up 100 feet. And once it went over the limb of the tree, he put his thumb on the line just a little bit, causing a little bit of drag. And instead of it keeping going through the neighbor's window, it came down straight next to the trunk, which is where you want it. It's hard to get it in there, usually. It was just a miracle work that he did, and he did like 3 or 4 halyards for me in half an hour, and I was very impressed with that. While I'm not a fisherman, my son is, and he has a habit of leaving, turned 40. He still leaves stuff at our house. So there was a fishing rod around until I busted it. But I used that. The other guy, it took one shot and he was over. With me, it was 5 shots. But still, it can go very handily, and it's sort of built-in line management with the reel on the pole. And that worked quite well. So it's, you know, if you have access to a fishing pole, it doesn't have to be a fancy one. You don't care if you're fooling the trout here. We just want to get it up over the tree.
Yes.
Another thing that helps sometimes I found is you get a head start. You go up on the roof. If a tree gets near the roof, go on the roof, and it gives you, depending on how many stories you have, 20, 30 feet of a head start, which is very handy. Just be careful you don't throw yourself off the roof when you do it. But the latest thing seems to be what started out as potato guns.
Yes.
Pneumatic tubes made out of PVC tubing that could fire a potato. Yes. Now, potatoes are not the best thing for this service, but it turns out if you get the right size PVC, you can fire a tennis ball. And that's much more neighbor friendly. If it hits the lawn mowing guy next door, you may not get on his Christmas list, but it's very effective. And you pump it up with a air compressor like you use for tires, and you push the trigger, and this thing goes sailing off over a tree. Now, the one thing you have to watch out for with that particularly, and other things as well, is wind resistance. Even a lead sinker has significant wind resistance. And if it's windy out, you'll find, even though you make a perfect shot, before it gets to the tree, it's 20 feet to the left or right because of the wind.
Yes.
And a tennis ball is even more so because it's less dense and it has more surface area. So it'll go quite a way. So probably best to have the wind at your back when you do that. It'll give you a little more range, but it's something to keep in mind. So all of those things work very well. And once you have the line over, as I mentioned earlier, you need to use a succession of line sizes, probably starting with twine, working your way up to what the halyard is going to be. Now, I find for the halyard, I like double braid, yacht braid, or some antenna manufacturers. The Wireman, for one, sells this stuff, which has an outer weather-resistant coating and an inner strength coating. And together, they make a very effective, non-stretching halyard.
That's what I use. In fact, mine is the outer is black Dacron. UV resistance?
That's what
resistant, I should say.
That's what I've been using as well. And a nice thing about that is, you know, a lot of rope and twine is white, which is really stands out against your tree trunk. Black disappears.
Yes.
Which is handy if you don't want people saying, what the heck is that rope doing going up your tree?
Yes.
Are you climbing that? But that's what I use. And the other thing is you need to decide how you're going to make this thing work. So one way is just pull it over the limb, which I often do. The problem with that is about half the time the rope becomes part of the tree. The tree grows around the rope, and there's no hope in moving it anymore unless you remove the tree or remove the tree limb. So that happens about half the time. The other half the time, the tree moving back and forth chafes the rope and it breaks. But it's a much better arrangement to, and this is shown in the ARL antenna book, for example, to haul up a pulley of the type used for clothesline and use that to pull the antenna up. Now, that way, any chafing is not going to happen because the halyard is over a pulley, which has the ability to move back and forth as the tree moves. And in addition, the tree can't grow into it. In fact, if the tree grows around that rope that's holding the pulley up, that's not a bad thing either. I had a note from Jeff, WB4WXD, who suggests that rather than using pulleys, use carabiners, the little snap closing things that mountain climbers use to hang on to the pegs they drive into the rock. And they are not terribly expensive, and they don't jam. There's really no reason not to use them. I use some of them on the boat for jib halyards that aren't used very often. And it works very well. In fact, I was thinking about this. I was trying to help a friend hoist a Yagi up on top of a structure that he had. And the high-strength stainless steel line that he was using to do this with, which was rated for hundreds of pounds, kept breaking. We said, what is going on here? And finally, he ran out of line and gave up. And days later, I said, oh, I know what happened. The pulley froze up. The bearings in the pulley stopped working. It wasn't turning. So the pulley was sitting there stationary, and if you pull against it with a weight on each side, you know, you pulling on one side, the Yagi pulling on the other, instead of moving, it breaks.
Yes.
So, you know, pulleys are not all that great a solution, especially the kind that are used for clotheslines, which are not the same quality as some of the, say, marine pulleys that we may be used to.
Something else we're starting to see that we should mention is some amateurs are using drones now, and they're attaching their lines to the drones. I mean, thin lines, like fishing line. And they're flying their drones up over the target limb or over the target tree, and then coming down the other side and then landing or hovering on the grass on the other side and doing it that way.
Oh, that's perfect. I've thought about it. I've imagined that when I've seen, I didn't think of it for this preparation for today, but I have thought about that as I looked at drones and say, boy, that would be a way to get a halyard over a tree.
Yeah.
Because it takes the windage problem away. I guess if it's windy enough, the drone may have trouble staying.
That's true.
In
yes.
place, but at least you can see it having a problem and you do something about it. But that sounds like a great idea.
We have an article coming up in the August issue of QST, just a short article about a fellow who used his drone to inspect his antenna. Once mm-hmm. it was up, it has a high definition camera on it, and he just goes up and, you know, after winter and takes a look at the center insulator and all that, make sure everything's fine. And that's handy too. That's a little off topic, but still, yeah.
That is a great idea too. I've seen clips of people's antennas that they've done that, and mm-hmm. It's rather dramatic.
And drones are becoming much less expensive than they used to be for a good one that is stable and relatively easy to fly.
And this could be an excuse for buying one.
That's true.
If you needed one.
Well, Joe, let's hear from DX Engineering.
Okay.
And we will be back.
Every ham radio operator knows speed matters. Whether it's jumping in your truck during an emergency or staying up all night for lightning quick contesting, seconds count. And there's nothing more painful than being off the air waiting for equipment to arrive. At DX Engineering, we know a thing or two about speed. You can count on us to provide the fastest shipping in the ham universe. How fast? You get same-day shipping on most orders placed by 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's that fast. So that new rig, antenna, cable assembly, or replacement part you need will make it to your shack in plenty of time to work a remote DXCC entity or dominate the competition in the next contest. And the best part is DX Engineering offers free shipping for most orders over $99. Radio waves travel at the speed of light. Lucky for you, so does DX Engineering. Visit dxengineering.com. That's dxengineering.com.
And we're back. And Jeff, WB9DAN, is asking, will a 30 megahertz cutoff low-pass filter work in reverse, so to speak, if I connected it to a receiver? I know the primary purpose of a low-pass filter is to attenuate transmitter harmonics above 30 megahertz, but can it also attenuate frequencies above 30 megahertz from finding their way into the receiver? What say?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it doesn't know which direction the signals are going or where the signals are coming from.
It doesn't?
I don't think so. No filter that I've had. And I have a few if somebody wants to make me an offer. But a low-pass filter can be used to work in either direction. Now, one caution about low-pass filters is most of them were produced in the day, in the 50s, let's say, when transmitters went up to 30 megahertz, as you point out. But be aware that since your transceiver works up to 6 meters probably, or most modern transceivers do, it will also attenuate 6 meters. So if you want to use 6 meters, you have to think about how you're going to wire that up. Maybe with a separate antenna, it would work okay. But in most cases, modern HF gear is pretty good at eliminating responses to VHF signals and other out-of-band signals. But there may be an exception if you live right next to a TV or FM, commercial FM transmitter that's putting out 50,000 watts. It may cause some desensitivity of your receiver. If that's the case, a filter like this may be just what you need. And if you go to any flea market, I don't know if anybody sells these anymore, but if you go to any flea market, you'll find piles of them around.
I've seen a few for sale, but no, you're right, not many.
I've just pushing around a pile of them in my basement the other day, so make me an offer.
But anyway, to go to eBay. Yes.
Yeah, that's another good place. Now, there were some low-pass filters back in the day that had a cutoff higher than 30 megahertz designed to work on 6 meters. They typically would cut off at 52 megahertz, which would allow 6-meter signals in the what's now the CW sideband portion primarily to pass, and they would still attenuate signals that would be in channel 2, which started at 54. Now, of course, channel 2 I don't think is used as a TV channel very many places anymore. I don't know.
Probably not, no.
Yeah, they've moved a lot of things out. And that brings up the point that These filters were designed in the days of AM transmitters that generally had Class C amplifiers as their final modulated stage. And the Class C amplifier is inherently non-linear and thus generates many harmonics.
Yes.
While the output stage of the transmitter tended to reduce them, it would not meet current purity standards.
Hardly, no.
This combined with the often weak over-the-air TV reception of the 50s and 60s and poorly designed TV sets resulted in lots of TV interference. And this was a big problem, perhaps the biggest problem for amateurs in those periods. I was there then.
Oh, it was huge. If you go back and read QSTs from that era, you find a lot of discussion about it.
Absolutely. But today, it's a different story. Transceivers designed for SSB use linear amplifiers. Even if they're operating CW, they use linear amplifiers. And on AM, the AM is generated at low levels, and then the amplification is done with linear amplifiers. But even more important is that most TV reception, in my area at least, is over cable TV. And those that isn't comes over digital TV from broadcast stations, neither of which are as susceptible to interference as the old analog systems were that we used back in the 50s and 60s for television. So it's really unusual, but not unprecedented, to have TV interference problems. And most of the time, in my experience, it isn't coming in from the antenna, although it can be, not coming in directly from into the RF stage of the TV. It's coming in over the power lines or some other way that it gets into the TV. So there can be problems, but low-pass filters are generally not the solution this time period.
No, and because of all the evolution of modern electronics, you don't find low-pass filters very often.
You don't.
Well, thank you, Joel.
If you have a question for the doctor, email us at doctor@arrl.org. The Doctor Is In podcast is sponsored by DX Engineering at www.dxengineering.com. Background music provided by Purple Planet at www.purple-planet.com. This podcast is copyright ARRL. All rights are reserved. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.
This podcast has its own chat on the internet. It's a motley crew for it. There is this Belgian guy, Oscar Nancy 3, Juliet Victor Bravo. Don't know what to think of him. And then there is Ernst Dicker Ernst. He jokes a lot about a goat. Strange obsession. And then there's Case. He is cousins with this funny performer, you know, Katinka with the same surname. And we also have Peter. BRJ. Peter seems to be a bit of an Apple fan. PA3CAS is much into crypto. And Aline, don't know about her. Well, she looks like a nice person to be with. We also have our funny duo, Bob and Berry Pie, on our chat channel. And then there is Cool Pascal. The guy's so cool. At least he thinks he is, I guess. We also have a lot of SWLs that I don't mention personally. They mostly listen. Well, sorry if I forgot someone. Goodbye for now.
This podcast is made by myself. I'm Peter John in English Media. Title music is by Croatian artist Blasco and is published under Creative Commons. You can find this podcast on dmpodcast.net, DM is for Daily Minutes, and on several other platforms. De internetfaciliteiten en studio hardware voor Daily Minutes worden gesponsord door 70MHzShop.nl. 70MHzShop.nl.
Daily Minutes Podcast. Whoever hears this is crazy.
Are you feeling bored of your everyday strenuous working exercise? There are times when I feel like doing something new, something different. One of the hottest workouts in India is a laughter workout. Yes, it's made to feel you laugh.
Ha ha. Ha ha ha. Ha ha ha. Ha 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 ha
This is Slow Scan Radio. Good afternoon, this is Peter John. We bring you experiments with Slow Scan TV images, mostly photos, and also several kinds of data transmission using FLDigi. We have a show sending some data, and mostly SSTV images. The images can be received with your normal radio. The easiest way is to use a smartphone, holding it simply close to the receiver speaker. You will need an app like Robot 36 for Android or CQ SSTV for iOS then. There are also good programs for PC. More info about that you can find on our website www.slowscanradio.com. www.slowscanradio.com. For the data, preferably use FLDigi, although other programs most probably will work as well.
Thank you.
Slow Scan Radio is copyright 2018, excluding rights of featured items and any music. Website is www.slowscanradio.com. Mail address is xray@xraydeltavictor.mikeecho.com.